you about, I think, several things we're doing in my group, all based on all problems that happen in lipid membranes. Some of them inside living cells, some of them not inside living cells. And our angle on these problems is very much experimental. And it's based on developing new types of technologies for handling and manipulating lipid membranes that allow us to probe these systems in ways that have been difficult. So the three areas I'll discuss, primarily I'll start out with this one that's in the title, looking at a signaling system in a T cell. And the point here is this is a living cell, and signals start from proteins that reside in the cell membrane. And so the physical properties, the spatial organization, mechanical properties of that environment basically sets the boundary condition from which the signal propagates inside the cell. And in this case, in particular, the signals are between two cell surfaces. So on the other side, the ligands being displayed are also in a membrane, and its physical properties now couple into this. And so we're trying to develop ways to make artificial surfaces that allow us to couple to the living cell in controlled ways. And one of the things that emerges from that, and this will be clear as I go through that story, is that the spatial arrangement, and in particular the tendency of membranes to become organized into spatial patterns and for discrete domains to interact with each other over long distances, and long distances is the key, that is extremely important in the behavior of cell membranes. And so we continue to look at a variety of reconstituted lipid systems. So this is now lipids, cholesterol, sometimes proteins, but not alive, so outside of the cell. And look at their self-assembly, their organizational properties to give us some insights as to what might be going on here. And it's been a lot of fun in the group trying to have two different sides doing these two things at the same time. The people studying the live cells really keep us honest, I have to say. And then thirdly, I'd like to just end, if there's time, with another area, another form of supportive membrane technology that we're trying to use to study these things, lipid membranes on colloidal particles. But this has taken a very unexpected turn recently, in the sense that we started out trying to use the particles to understand something about membranes. But in the end, I think the membranes may help us understand something about colloidal particles and electrostatics and water, which we don't currently understand, so it's more of an open problem. Hopefully I'll have time to discuss that at the end. Okay, so let's begin just with a brief review. I think it's a rather broad audience on this particular system, the T cell. So we're not a T cell biology lab by any stretch of the imagination, and we're not an immunology lab either. We really are kind of a membrane physical chemistry lab, but this problem is a really attractive one to get into for a variety of reasons. Now, first of all, the T cell is just important in health and disease. So it's the front line of your adaptive immune system. T cells patrol your body, and they're sampling surfaces as they go. And it's the job of the T cell, one of their primary jobs, that is, to identify if a cell that they have encountered has been infected by a virus. This is actually a difficult problem because the virus resides inside of the cell. So you have to ask yourself, what can a T cell do to detect this virus at a distance? It doesn't have things like fancy, you know, microscopies and optics that it can do. It has chemicals, and that's what it has to do. But it works with the other cell, and your body has evolved really an ingenious system of inside the cell, you're constantly synthesizing proteins. Obviously, this costs energy. But with some reasonably high probability, a protein that's synthesized, the instant it's synthesized, it's immediately degraded and never functions. And those fragments are trafficked to the cell surface where they're displayed in a protein called the major histocompatibility complex. Takes these peptide fragments from inside the cell, that proteins that never were allowed to function, and just puts them on the surface. And what it does, that's the little internal audit. It's a snapshot of all the proteins that are being produced in the cell at that moment in time. The T cell's job is just to scan these somehow and determine whether that sequence can be found in your genome or not. If it can, this is from one of your proteins. Nothing is wrong. It's just something that should be there. And the T cell needs to ignore that cell. But on the other hand, if it finds a sequence that's not part of your genome, that is an indication that there's something else in there, like a virus. And the T cell then starts a process of destroying that cell. It basically triggers the immune system. This is an extremely challenging problem, though, in just combinatorial chemistry. And the T cell receptor, it does this recognition. It's a protein. It's like an antibody. It has this hypervariable region. You have a whole population, perhaps 100 million strong, of uniquely different T cells that are looking for all these things. And there's a way of combinatorial producing these cells and screening them. So you can think of it kind of like an antibody, but it's attached to a living cell, which allows it to do more things than just bind. That's all an antibody does, but a T cell can really react. So it's a fascinating system. It works, too. You can recover from the flu. That's a result of your T cells recognizing those viral peptides. It also can fail, and that's when you get a variety of autoimmune diseases like psoriasis and diabetes and arthritis. All can be traced, in some cases, to faulty T cell interactions. So with all this thing that T cell can do, it's a very important problem. A lot of people studied it. And I think what attracted me to it was how much was known about this. So for a physical chemist to try to get into a biological problem, you need actual facts. It's very difficult to work when things are being sort of just are not known. A tremendous amount was known. We have the crystal structures of all these proteins, sometimes with the peptides there. You know where every last molecule and atom is just about in the system. But the answer is just not there at all. So here's a situation where the details, you can drill to the bottom and get all the details, but the answer does not emerge. So that's fascinating. And
what's the question?
How does it work?
Okay. Yeah, there was, I don't know, I haven't done this work for a long time, but in my days, the key problem was there are here much more different peptide structure that T cell, different T cells. So where is the diversity is coming from? Recognition of diversity, and I guess you're going to update us on.
Well, I would say all of those things. Yeah, the question, the biggest question of all is that you have these proteins that are binding this and somehow recognizing the peptide in there, and that modulates the binding properties of the protein a little bit. And one thing you can show for sure is that at the single molecule level, this has nowhere near the recognition specificity required to regulate the interaction with the precision that's known to be regulated with. So it looks like a chemical impossibility.
Yeah, I think this is a great example of what we were talking about yesterday. You were here yesterday, right?
I'm sorry, I wasn't.
Oh, well, you missed it.
En route.
Peace.
So this, the question would be, what is the property of this material that allows it to perform its actions?
That's exactly the question.
You know, rather than how it works. So I think, you know, I would love to talk later about this and have a workshop on this problem. Some of my students are in class doing this, and that's exactly one thing they look at MHC.
Oh, okay. Proteins.
And so they're reverse engineering the MHC protein down to this level.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, so
I would love to talk about that.
How big are the peptides that are exposed?
Relatively small. I think these are in the 12 to 20 range.
Generation of diversity.
So what you kind of get out of it is it doesn't work at the single molecule level. And so there is some kind of population dynamics or collective property of the system that gives the specificity and that you don't get by trying to look at individuals. And so, you know, in multiple fields at the same time, more or less, I think people began to realize that this had to be the case and the answer would be there. And so in several labs, more or less simultaneously around 1998, 1999, the cellular immunologists looking at these T cells began to image the interface. And I think this really was a major transition in the field. And people will say different things about it, but just by the fact that this paper of Mike Dustin has nearly 1,000 citations in 6 years does tell you something about the relevant impact it had in the field. And what they realized is that the proteins are not organized homogeneously in the interface. That you have this reaction of T cell receptors and MHC, and somehow in there, recognition is happening. and its signals are being triggered. But if you looked at the proteins, imaged them, you find that they get distributed in spatial patterns, and the spatial arrangement of the proteins was different in different situations. And if you tried to understand this in terms of just pure chemistry, like the real chemical view would be, let's count the number of individuals we have that are not bound, the number that are ligated. That's kind of a chemical reaction. I've drawn them all ligated here, in here. But you know, there would be some kind of a reaction going on. Count up the number of each type and determine the affinity, determine the strength of the signal. You could never explain things that way, it turned out. The cells were just always in different configurations, and nothing really made a lot of sense. One thing that was realized, though, at that time, is that if you image the spatial pattern, the spatial organization of the proteins correlated with cellular behavior very well, more so than adding up the numbers. So it's a little bit like realizing you have to pay attention to the order of the letters in a sentence, not just the number of each type, to get the meaning. And that means that there could be a significantly larger amount of information in these chemical reactions than you might guess just by thinking of it as a chemical reaction. And one thing I would point out is that, you know, the T cell, so when it's an immature T cell in a thymocyte in your thymus being screened, that's how your body gets rid of the autoreactive ones. It just makes them randomly, and then it kills off the ones that react against yourself. Synapses form there too with the very same proteins, T cell receptor. This is the adhesion molecule LFA on the T cell. What's red and green here are identical proteins to the ones here. Different spatial pattern. Almost the same cell too, but in this case you trigger apoptosis. The cell kills itself, triggered through the T cell receptor. And in this case, triggering the T cell receptor in that cell triggers cytotoxicity. So you get drastically different responses from the same receptor and the same, by and large, the same signaling system. That's hard to explain. But you can look at the spatial distribution and it's very different. And so that appears to be an important component of this system. So that's really, yes?
What's a thymocyte?
A thymocyte is a young T cell.
Okay.
The thymocyte is then in the thymus, and at that point it's being screened, and so it needs to be triggered slightly to sort of determine that it actually has a good T cell receptor, because it's making these randomly. But if it triggers strongly in the thymus off of one of your own peptides, which are being displayed there, then it gets killed.
And does cytotoxicity mean the T cell kills the other cell?
Yes. So cytotoxicity is now out in the body. The T cell, when it does this, it can either directly kill the cell or it can proliferate itself to achieve the same effect.
Do the pattern, for example, for the cytotoxicity response, do they vary dependent of the antigen?
No.
They're always, so cytotoxic signals are always patterned, have that pattern.
Yeah, this canonical pattern of a ring of adhesion molecules surrounding a centralized cluster of T cell receptor is pretty much always seen when there's a large amount of antigen. Some different things can happen when it's extremely small numbers. A T cell can recognize as few as two individual molecules. Interestingly, they'll never trigger on one. It doesn't have stochastic noise. So part of all of this is, how does the T cell get around these problems? Triggering accidentally would give you an autoimmune disease.
Does this spatial pattern correlate
with the cell types?
Yeah,
I mean, there are. I'm simplifying the T cell a little bit here. There are several different types of T cells, and they do have slightly different things that they do. There's going to be cytotoxic, and the one I'm going to talk about, the triggering the T cell results in proliferation. It looks identical to this, but some of them are slightly different. This is another type of cell, which I won't talk about at all today, a natural killer cell, and it has receptors that are similar to T cell receptors and different. So it looks like there's a whole zoology of patterns for different cells of the immune system. But the real question then is, so these patterns exist, and they correlate with things that the cell is doing. But are they causally related to it? Are they playing a functional role? Or it could certainly be that the pattern just results from the cell doing something. And then you get things pushed and moved around, and you end up with a pattern. It has nothing to So correlation exists, but figuring out what's causing what is still a very open question. And so I'll focus really exclusively on the T cell and the question of where does that pattern come from and what is it doing? So there's sort of two levels to that question. And one is at the very physical level. What pattern-forming tendencies exist at this interface between two cells that could cause proteins to become arranged in these patterns? So where are the patterns coming from? It's easy to say the cell makes a pattern, but what makes the pattern in the cell? It still has to come from somewhere. And we'd like to believe that all these things result from, you know, physical forces. So just as a sort of an example, something we did some time ago when we first began to think about this was to look at one thing, is that there's a size mismatch between the T cell receptor MHC complex. So when it's complex, that's a rigid thing. And the adhesion molecules, which have to engage for this cell to be triggered. There's a pretty large size mismatch between the two of these. So when you see them separating from each other, there are some potentially obvious things to think about that it could simply be size exclusion here, that you've pulled the membrane to a certain spacing there, excluding these. Similarly, when one T cell receptor engages, because of the mechanical properties of the membrane, you could change the affinity of a T cell receptor remote from that one just by positioning the membranes, on average, more near the optimal spacing. So there are some interesting dynamics just from the fact that these molecules are coupled to move in a membrane that fluctuates. And when one of them binds, that changes the fluctuation spectrum of the membrane, and now you have a mechanical coupling. That's one interesting thing. And there are a lot of others, but the mechanical properties of the membrane keep emerging as a potentially very important thing here. Question.
It also changes the number of unbound versus bound receptors. We had an experiment a few years ago where we took biotin and avidin between two vesicles, and the more receptors get bound, the more there's a concentration gradient for free receptors to move into the zone too.
Oh, sure, sure.
And
yeah.
So you know, receptor accumulation can also be part of this dynamic process, I think.
Yeah, and you will see a situation in a T cell where exactly that might be at the what's nucleating the signaling process. The other question, though, which is very big, is we know the patterns are there, so they're obviously they're getting there somehow. But how does the spatial pattern affect the signaling network? So this T cell receptor, like any other signaling molecule on a cell surface, is linked up to a fairly elaborate signal transduction network where when the T cell receptor, so this is just flipped upside down from the previous slide, binds to the MHC with the peptide, this binding, along with other things like CD4, kind of finding that MHC, ultimately triggers a phosphorylation of the T cell receptor on this so-called zeta chain. When it gets phosphorylated a number of times sequentially, that triggers the next thing, and so on and so forth. You get calcium oscillations. And ultimately, you get to an endpoint where you can change the fate of the cell. So the cell has made a decision to do something. But it propagates through some exotic system of processes like this. And the question then is, well, there are a lot of signaling network maps that you can find in the literature like this, but rarely do they really think about the fact that the concentrations of all these species are not necessarily spatially homogeneous within the cell. And how does the spatial distribution of this couple to that? So how is spatial distribution being used? And is it being used? Like, is it a part of the way that you regulate this signaling network? So that was another question. So does the spatial pattern really matter at the level of signaling? And so,
if a cell's infected with a virus, then the pattern of these receptors, there's a hypothesis and that may change?
No, actually, because I think, let me clarify
that.
I flipped the orientation of this just because I took that picture from someone's paper. The T cell, which is on the top here, is on the bottom there. So this is the antigen-presenting cell, so that's the one that's infected by the virus.
So the T cell, and this is the case where the T cell is going to kill that cell, right?
Yes, and so this would be the cell that's infected, the antigen-presenting cell.
And so so those receptors there, those green and red things, you're suggesting that they're going to change when they're infected versus not infected?
Well, all of the patterns that you see here really are coming from the T cell.
I understand.
Not from the antigen-presenting cell. So what's happening is that the only thing in the antigen-presenting cell, the only thing, are the peptides on the surface. That's the only visible thing. And what's then is that recognition, so when the T cell receptor recognizes this peptide and binds to it, this is a passive process on the side of the antigen-presenting cell. And that makes sense because there's no way a T cell could expect the antigen-presenting cell to cooperate. It could be very badly.
No, clearly.
So from here down, we really assume that there's nothing coming up from that cell and focus entirely on what's going on inside of the T cell. So
you must see before the T cell attached is ADC, the pattern has already.
No, there's no patterns before engagement. So none of these proteins are organized in any sort of pattern prior to touchdown.
Well, so then why do you think this pattern is important?
Because the pattern always shows up when the cells get triggered. So what happens is you have two homogeneous cell surfaces. T cell is homogeneous, the antigen-presenting cell looks homogeneous. You can see that. I'll show some pictures of that later. They contact each other. If there's no antigen there, the T cell remains homogeneous, and it sits there for a while, and then it leaves. But if there is an antigen there, that pattern shows up, and the T cell gets triggered.
Is that specific to T cells, or is I thought that happens for any kind of cell-cell adhesion, no matter what cells are adhering to one another?
Well, it certainly does not happen no matter what, because it only happens if the antigen is there. So the T cell can adhere to another cell with all these proteins and everything there, and if you have a different peptide in here, you don't get that pattern. So
well,
the
you
pattern
say that pattern mean that specific arrangement or any kind of a pattern?
You get no pattern. And I'll show you this. If you put a single amino acid change in that peptide and let a T cell come down, this is a completely homogeneous.
Yeah, and in these adhesions, it's not like, you know, endothelial cell adhesion and little focal contacts and vinculin, tailing, and that whole thing. This is more connected to the next signal transduction pathway.
That's exactly right. So the case of the T cell.
What's a signal? How do you see that?
It's a deal when maybe they want to stand the experiment.
Wait, two questions.
Sorry. No, I think she was.
Okay. So let me show you then. The fact is, you don't have to speculate about these patterns because they're readily visible. And in the case of the T cell, I think one of the things that emerges is that there's a remarkably wide range of different patterns that come up under circumstances that are almost identical. And so in that case, it's almost like it's sitting on the border of some sort of a transition. Now other cells that form more static patterns might always, just sort of, you adhere tightly in some place and you exclude some other proteins. The T cell seems to be a little bit different. The pattern seems to have a meaning to it because it correlates with things in an apparently causal way. But that's really the question, is that the case, or are we just seeing byproducts of something that's going on? So then we'll just turn this upside down and look at what's going on inside the T cell. And so all of this is alive, right? And that first interaction here occurs before any pattern has shown up at all. They're randomly distributed. Somehow, and it doesn't change unless the antigen is there. Somehow, because of the antigen, there's a feedback through this that changes the organization of the T cell receptors. And that's kind of the observation. And the question is, well, what does that mean?
Can you point out before you leave that slide, how much of those other enzymes are actually membrane bound? Not necessarily the plasma membrane, but it's very close to the membrane in a. And the one thing is, these enzymes are not just free in suspension.
Well, yeah. So things like this LCK, which is kind of an important one, it is soluble, but its association with this signaling complex is somehow regulated by signaling itself. So. You know, the kinds of things that people believe here is that this molecule CD4, which is in the membrane, actually binds both the MHC and the T cell receptor, and it can position this one near that to do the phosphorylation. So they become associated through proteins, but they're not membrane proteins themselves, but they do get localized to the membrane.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm not clear what we're looking at. Is this a purely symbolic, functional iconography we have there?
Yeah.
Or would you actually see a little blob of LCK given a sufficient...
This is purely symbolic, and these little blobs are probably the biologist's way of imagining the shape of the protein.
The pretty flower shapes and that sort of thing is all purely symbolic. None of it is representational.
In this picture, yes.
And out of proportion, too. You know.
Yeah. There's more than one of each protein. But what we will do is we can image each one of these things, and you can watch how they're distributed in the cell. And you know, later on, we'll look at some of that stuff and see what's happening to it. But at this level, this is like a list of chemical reactions that could occur, and without any discussion of the spatial arrangement of them.
So according to you, you have aggregation of T cell receptors first. And then you have adhesion molecules that come around them, and they stick there, so you can...
Actually, the adhesion molecules probably appear first.
So they... But you show this, right?
Yeah.
But you need to go on. And
yeah. Okay, let's move on. So, anyway, the point is you can study this system very, very easily using supportive bilayers. The great, really, from my perspective, the greatest thing about T-cells is that a T-cell, it does not require the cooperation of the antigen-presenting cell. You can make an artificial antigen-presenting cell with a supported lipid bilayer on a glass surface, or any other surface for that matter, that will support bilayers, and incorporate the adhesion proteins, the MHC, the right peptide. Change the peptide, you get a different response. And you'll form these synapses on the glass surface in an antigen-specific way, and you'll trigger T cells. So you can set up the whole thing, which looks very much like it does in vivo, but on a supported membrane. And this is really easy to image.
Yeah, but the antigen is being processed. If you just roll over human, it will not do it. You know, it had to be the peptide that's being processed.
That's right. So we'll synthesize a processed peptide.
Yeah.
And we take T cells from transgenic mice where we know we have exactly which T cell receptor, and we present, for example, the moth cytochrome C peptide of this particular part, and you get the reaction. So that system works, and in fact, that's been used for a long time by immunologists. So that's the sort of point of entry. But the idea then was this: what we'd really like to do is we'd like to control the pattern of the molecule. So that's the sort of observation. You see a pattern, it correlates with behavior. If you want to do an experiment, you need to be able to perturb the pattern. And so many experiments that have been done on these cells involve chemical perturbations. You can add a drug that blocks the assembly of the cytoskeleton, or you can add drugs that deplete cholesterol from the membrane, or you can do a genetic mutation. You can change a protein from what it is naturally to something else. All chemical perturbations, all of which are really not tightly focused on the issue of spatial pattern. There's no genetic code, sort of one point mutation that switches the pattern. And if that's what we want to study, we really need a different type of mechanism of perturbing the cell. So the idea was, let's take advantage of the supported bilayer and the fact that we could fabricate structures onto the solid support, which then control the mobility of these things. So you can control the mobility of lipids, and proteins like this that are in the membrane become subject to these spatial constraints as well. So they'll diffuse freely in here. The free diffusion is key, too, because you want this cell to assemble the signaling apparatus. We just want to control its large-scale movement. If you block this short-range motion, then you don't get normal signaling at all. So we want the short-range mobility so you can assemble a protein complex, but let's control long-range mobility with these structures. And so we had this idea, maybe we could do this, and a postdoc of mine, Raghu Parthasarathy, painted this painting for us. Which depicts it fairly nicely. But you can actually do that. So we would then go and, by electron beam lithography, fabricate thin lines of chrome on glass. They are effective barriers to lateral diffusion of lipids and proteins. Load them up with the proteins and the membranes, and drop down T cells. So these are fresh out of a mouse. And we know exactly what T cell receptor they have. That's another just incredible thing about this particular system is you can buy a mouse, a transgenic mouse, that has one type of T cell. And you know exactly what peptide it recognizes. So they're all clones of each other, identical. So you do that, drop them down. It's probably no coincidence that they find these little vertices here too. But I'm not going to go into that. And they form synapses on these surfaces. So here's the T cell and in a bright field image. And here's the fluorescence, three different colors of MHC and TCR in yellow and green, respectively. And then the adhesion molecule, ICAM, in red. So you see that ring pattern forming. So that's the native pattern. Healthy T cell, nothing wrong with it. Nearby, on the same substrate, we had a region with straight lines of chrome. So these 100 nanometers wide, they look much wider than they really are because they're diffracted. The T cell landed here, and on striped, on these type of constraints, the T cells always form striped synapses. Really, what's happening is they land, proteins bind everywhere, and then they transport, staying bound. They don't let go, which is kind of odd because the off rate is once per second. So that was one peculiar observation. They're not in any sort of equilibrium-like situation. They bind, and the observed on-off rates change drastically, probably because they're clustering together right away. But you get these stripes of T cell receptor flanked by stripes of adhesion molecules. On grids, you get different things. You sort of get roughly one cluster per grid element, and they get pulled into the corners. You can kind of see that, but they don't cross, so you end up with a multifocal synapse. This is kind of the most interesting one at the first level, because we've prevented the formation of a single centralized cluster. Now that central cluster was named when it was first observed, the central supramolecular activating cluster. That's the key thing. Activating cluster has that name, CSMAC, very widely used term. It's so compelling, right? You see things cluster together, there's strength in numbers. Of course, clustering amplifies. There's actually no evidence for that, but that's just so obvious. That's why it got that name. So this is a perfect way of sort of looking at what happens if you don't allow that thing to form. What happens if the central supramolecular activating cluster is prevented? Question.
The picture in the center, the stripes are perpendicular to the chrome line, right?
Yes, so the same orientation. The real reason is that, just imagine, see, the T cell lands and all of the T cell receptors bind, and then it has a radial transport process to the center. And so things can move freely along this direction. So those things invert normally, but in this dimension they can't. So it just doesn't. So that's why you get the one-dimensional compression.
It seems to me for all those three images, you have the center active site. So do you have images which you don't have that?
You mean there's nothing in the center?
Yeah.
Well, you'll see others. When you make grid sizes of different sizes, this gets more and more distributed.
Just going back to Phil's question,
yeah.
Is there any internal protein focal contact that goes with the adhesion molecule? Are there any cytoskeletal,
Everything is associated with the cytoskeleton.
But is it being assembled in the same way? If you label, say, vinculin or tailing active, do you see it co-localized with the adhesion receptor? Is there anything going on like that on the inside of the live cell?
Yes. And right now we're in the process of doing some of these actin experiments. Both the adhesion molecules and the T cell receptor are connected to the cytoskeleton and moving in opposite directions.
Because, there's obviously a pattern associated with the cytoskeleton.
Yes, and actually, I think that's really what the hypothesis is that the cytoskeleton and triggering changes in the way the cytoskeleton moves around these proteins is what drives these patterns. And cytoskeleton is known. If you disrupt that, you'd also disrupt the regulation of the T cell receptor. And so the real question is spatial changes in the organization of the T cell receptor as regulated by the cytoskeleton, is that how cytoskeleton regulates signal by spatially moving things? That's kind of the question we wanted to probe. So what we can do is look at these and try to figure out what's going on. We can do it in a few different ways. This supported bilayer configuration is the easiest possible way to do single molecule experiments in cells. You can easily see single proteins moving around. This is a hard thing to do if you're trying to go inside the cell, but when the cell cell puts everything right up on the support. This is not hard. And we can watch these. So we can watch, for example, the assembly of the synapse. I probably could have showed this before to help answer that question. So this is what it looks like. Here's the cell just dropped down. These are the T cell receptors. They're probably already clustered into groups of 3 or 5 at that point. So these are, we don't think these are single molecules just here. But they're not, they haven't moved yet. The cell just landed, and you can pick out these spots. That's 5 seconds after touchdown. And then they start to move, so we're tracking them here. And they move in radially. But this cell is actually on one of these gridded substrates. We draw the grids in on green here in the same picture. So you can see them. These have no barriers. It just comes straight in. But this one comes up and hits. And you can actually pick individuals of these tracks and track them along. They come, hit the barriers, and then they move laterally along. So it kind of affects the distribution in exactly the way you would think.
Jay, is this generic independent of the nature of the supportive bilayer as long as it's fluid?
Yes. Yes. From what we've seen, the lipids in the supportive bilayer are not critical. And the proteins are pretty large, so it kind of weighs away from the lipids. But there is one thing, which I'll get to. I just mention it now. I'll primarily talk about these diffusion constraints on a planar surface, but we also make surfaces that have curvature patterns. And then you deform the shape of the whole membrane, and that has a really interesting effect on the T cell, too. Question.
How do you know that they're on the surface?
How do I?
Like a vesicle going nearby the membrane.
Well, so the thing is, the only way this can be constrained by that barrier, which is just 5 nanometers high, it's only as high as the head of the lipids, and the cell's 50 nanometers away. The fact that these interact with the barrier, so we've got a T cell receptor on a T cell moving, the only way it can interact with the chrome barrier on the solid substrate underneath the lipid bilayer is by being engaged with the MHC. That's the protein that feels the barrier. So the fact that you see them come in, hit barriers, and move along them tells you that they're engaged to the MHC.
Yeah, but if you have, with a microtubule network, and this network is somehow feels the barriers, and then it is monitoring the movement of the vesicles around this network.
I don't know, somehow feels the barriers, because the cells do not apparently interact with the barriers unless they engage the protein there. So we've never seen protein in a cell free other proteins. You do not see the cells kind of generically interacting with these substrates. It's really just like paint on the ground, you know, and you have to be interactive with something that's interacting with that to feel it. Now, it is true that everything else that interacts with the T cell receptor will also become subject to those constraints. But since they don't have any ligand in the supportive membrane, they have to be through their interaction with the T cell receptor. So if you look at things that don't have ligands in membrane, they just go right across.
So how do the specificity control look like a different peptide, for example?
Yeah, then you see no interactions at all. You see T cell receptors just randomly distributed, and they diffuse around, and they let go, they diffuse and come back down. And so you don't see any evidence of the barriers when you have a different peptide there.
And how many fluorophores? I mean, if you look at the depletion profile, do they bleach like abruptly, or I just...
The number of fluorophores, so we have the T cell receptors labeled with a Fab fragment which binds to the outside, from the outside to the T cell receptor without interfering with its function, and that has 2 to 3 fluorophores on it.
Yeah, I mean, in that spot, I'm looking at how many fluorophores are there. Does that spot kind of plays out abruptly, or it just stays? I mean, when you detect single fluorophores, one of the.
Well, when you're looking at a single molecule, you don't see a slow fade. These are groups of probably, first of all, these are in the T cell, not in the supportive bilayer. Those groups, we have probably 3 to 5 molecules based on their bleaching profile.
Okay, this one.
Yeah. And you can readily see the single molecules in the supportive bilayer if you look at that. I didn't bring those images, but
well,
we characterize the supportive membrane that way.
Your bleaching profile is consistent with, say, 15 fluorophores, right?
Yeah, so for these clusters, you do not see step bleaches. And roughly, it's probably in that range. Okay. So this is really just a look at how these things are forming. And the more complete story at the moment, and what I wanted to talk about, is trying to use those things to map what's going on in this signaling apparatus. So So we need something to probe inside of the cell to connect to this. And so one of the things we can look at is the phosphorylation state of the T cell receptor. So if T cell receptor sees antigen in the MHC, the result of that is it gets phosphorylated. It also gets organized into patterns, but it definitely gets phosphorylated. And we can stain for this. So you can take an antibody that will bind phosphorylated tyrosine residues. We can permeate the cell, fix it, and do what biologists call a fix and stain experiment. So you basically let the cell go for a certain point, and you kill it quickly, and then you perfuse antibodies in, and you can look where these things are. And you look at a pattern. So we do that, and so here's one of these synapses. This is at a 2-minute time point. So it hasn't really formed that central supramolecular activation cluster yet. Here's the native one, and here's on the grid. This is now a 2 by 2 micron grid, so you see more individual spots of T cell receptor, still one per box, though. But the important thing is the CSMAC has not formed. So even in the native cell, it's a bunch of individual clusters of T cell receptor. And we'll look at 100 cells like this, and you do kind of image analysis, and you see a few different things. So first of all, when you do this stain for phosphorylated tyrosine residues, you pick up every tyrosine that's phosphorylated, and not just the T cell receptor. But every place we have a cluster of T cell receptors, we also have a bright spot of phosphotyrosine. And so if you do a look for local bright spots in the phosphotyrosine image and then cross-correlate that with the T cell receptor pattern, we find 100%. Basically, every T cell receptor cluster here has a corresponding bright spot in the phosphorylation pattern, suggesting that all the T cell receptors are phosphorylated. So at 2 minutes, everything is triggered. You don't need that central supramolecular activation cluster to trigger. You probably do need these little clusters, but that's probably enough. And it's similar on the grids, they've also all triggered. It doesn't really matter to the cell that we forced them to be slightly more distributed. So far, these two are behaving the same. Where things get different is more by 5 minutes. So by the time the CSMAC has formed, and so here's what it looks like, just slightly better imaging, you realize it's not dense like it appears. It's actually just a coalescence of smaller clusters in the center of the cell. But the most striking thing right away is that by the time that the central supramolecular activating cluster is formed, the T cell receptors are no longer phosphorylated. There's no phosphorylation coming from them here. There's just that uniform background in the periphery of the cell that we had seen before. So there's no cross-correlation. In the restricted case, they are prevented from forming this by the grids. The ones in the middle become dephosphorylated with exactly the same time frame. So they trigger and they get shut down, just like this. But the ones that happened to be at the periphery, but where we prevented their transport to the center, those which are trapped continue to signal, but at least they're still phosphorylated. You still see all these bright spots that correlate with the positions of those clusters of T cell receptors. So that was the first hint that actually what this CSMAC is required for is required for shutting down the signal. So cell has received the signal already with its distribution of receptors. Once it got the signal, it needs to shut it off and move on to the next thing. And so it brings them to the middle to shut them off. So presumably, there's probably an enrichment of phosphatases in the middle and more kinases in the periphery. And we've actually presented a lot of antigen to the cell. So our picture of what's going on here is that the cytoskeleton, which is what does the moving here, is regulating the strength of signaling through a T cell receptor by spatially translocating it. And what has happened? At 2 minutes, the cell is homogeneous, and all receptors are triggering. As soon as the cell starts to receive a signal, now it's got to evaluate the strength of that signal. The cell, T cell remember, can detect from 2 to 10,000 peptides, and it knows how many. That's a very wide dynamic range. So what it seems to do, between 2 and 5 minutes, it sets up an internal gradient of the signal transduction network. We don't know exactly which proteins are being redistributed, but we know they must be, because now we see this differential behavior. Strong signaling from receptors in the periphery, very weak signaling from receptors in the middle. And so once you set that up, all you have to do is spatially move a receptor from the outside to the inside to turn down the strength of signaling. It's very efficient. Question?
So if I was, so this is how, would the cell get killed in this bottom situation? Would this fact that you restricted, not let these things localize as much as they would have otherwise? cell less effective at killing?
Well, we don't know that for a fact, but certainly the immunologists that I've spoken to on this sort of thing say, yeah, you have to turn off the signaling in order for the cell to continue on. But that's a problem to have this signaling network triggered, because it consumes a lot of the metabolism of the cell. So yeah, this would be a problem for its function, but we don't know that for a fact. That's kind of just an explanation.
If it's the wrong peptide, do you get no signaling at all?
I'll say that in just a second. Okay. This is at the level of phosphorylation. You can debate whether phosphorylation is a real measure of the function of the network. And so we could also go look further down at calcium oscillations, and I'll run through it quickly. When you trigger a T cell, you really get temporal oscillations in intracellular calcium levels. You can detect those using fluorescent probes. And when we do that, again, we see clear differences. Not big, because it's only a small number that are out here, but clear differences over populations of cells. Different intracellular calcium levels. So it seems that these clusters really are still signaling in the periphery. So we've actually changed the way they signal just by moving them. That would explain part of the reason it's so hard to develop therapeutics against T cells, is that if the function of the receptor depends on where it is in the cell, when you eat a pill, it doesn't know how to find the periphery or the center of the cell and drug the right protein. The molecule is identical, but its position matters.
The periphery is just the radius of curvature.
No, the periphery is because we define a coordinate system following what the cell seems to do. This is a relatively flat interface. Even in vivo, it's planar. So two cells pull up tight against each other. And so there is a center and there is a periphery. And it has some level of radial symmetry, just because you've got two soft things that kind of squeeze together.
But it's smaller than the contact area.
Yeah, where is it with respect to the contact
area? Oh, this is the edge of the cell. And so that's the whole cell. Yeah. So
it then it might be coupled to curvature.
So then it is coupled.
Yeah.
Because it's flat.
It's such down.
So the interface is entirely planar.
But if the contact line, there's curvature.
The edge is very curved.
Doesn't it come back?
No, it really isn't. If you looked at this, the geometry of this thing, it's probably like this.
Yes.
And so yes, there's a curvature there, but the width of our periphery is like this. So it's quite large. And so I agree curvature is important, but I think it has a slightly different role here. But there's curvature, and it definitely is significant. But not for this ring that we're seeing. It's something else.
So this picture is different than the picture you were presenting early on. With the cell coming down to the bilayer, which clearly showed a very curved cell. You're saying that locally this is quite tight.
I would say the first pictures probably should have been drawn more like this to be more accurate.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now that brings me to another question now. What is the thickness of your cell? Does that have an influence on your signaling patterns here? Because it looks like the edge are thinner than what the nucleus are and stuff.
They are thinner, and that might very well have something to do with it. That you
because you have less space to signal stuff, you have less space to move.
Of course, it signals more strongly out here, but that could be. It could be that when you just have lower volume, something else, the reaction is
flow,
tuned
different flow.
Yeah, but those are the things. So definitely, somehow the reaction behaves differently here than here. One way is that the concentrations are different, but another would be that that's a good point. I mean, the environment itself might just tune it. And it seems that the cell makes use of that somehow.
And how close is the top message in the box family?
This is probably not more than a micron or two.
So any structure that would connect the top to the bottom?
Well, you have this. Are there structures you're asking?
Yeah, it's like an lamellar podium, which is just full of.
That's pretty much what this looks like.
The
very edge of here does look like a lamellar podium, in fact.
So just one last question. How many grids are across the scale of that drawing on the board?
So this, if I should superimpose it on the board, it would just go across the whole thing. So here we've got half a dozen or so. You can do this at different sizes of grids. I mean, we've divided the T cell up into hundreds of individual clusters. And you get more or less the same effect. I mean, as they get smaller, they get harder to see. We chose 2 microns just because they're easy to look at. But we never saw a difference depending on size.
So the diffusion within those cells, those grids, is important, but the size of the grid seems to be.
We've never made them so small that we could actually disrupt the positive phase of the signal. We've only been able to disrupt its shutdown. But that, I mean, that is the issue. So how does it get amplified in the first place? If you make them small enough, like if you make it totally immobile, then you don't get the amplification. So at some level, it would stop.
Does this scenario also depends on the density of the graphene density of adhesion molecules between the cell and the
not cells? Much. The adhesion molecule seems to be required for the cell to just get pinned in the first place.
Because
but it does depend in interesting ways on the concentration of the MHC.
Because you have a lot of molecule that would make the cell stick like a tape. Then would flatten out more and fluctuate less than that.
Well, it's pretty much does stick like tape, and so you need adhesion molecules to get that situation, and then within that you have these reactions. But one of the earlier questions was what happens when you don't have the antigen? And see, if you change one amino acid in the peptide, so here's the MHC, actual crystal structure of it, with the same peptide we're looking at, amazingly, someone did that one. You change that one amino acid, that's a critical lysine residue there. And this is what these things look like. The T cell receptor looks like that. You can, on the grids, too, it doesn't make any difference. And these are diffusing around. So you track them, you see them moving up over the grids like they're not there. Here's a phosphotyrosine stain of the same thing. It just brought the intensity up here. There's basically no patterns at all. It's just low-level background. And so the difference, that single amino acid there, all of this structure here results as from the signaling that we're feeding back on the spatial distribution of the protein.
What is the single amino acid change? You know, polar, nonpolar?
Well, you can change it to almost anything. In fact, it's a lysine here, and if you change it to something else, you just don't get the recognition. So it's a more of a positive thing that that T cell receptor needs that lysine there. It also recognizes residues on the MHC.
So if you
we haven't done it. That has been studied in pretty exquisite detail, actually, how the peptides regulate T cell receptor MHC binding. But that's the problem that you can't solve, actually. That was the initial thing, is to try to figure it out based on peptide and protein binding, and you never can answer the problem that way, because you never get really strong specificity. We've actually taken advantage of this to do one other thing. I think I'm running out of time, so I'll just mention this. Because that's such a critical residue, we wanted to be able to extend our ability to probe this to control time and sort of where and when antigen is exposed to cell. So one of the things we did is we synthesized a peptide with one of these NVOC protected lysine. So this is a photocleavable group. Looks something like that. And we've shown now that this peptide also, the cells don't react to it. But the neat thing is you can flash it off with light and turn it into antigen. So here's the normal peptide. You see these TCR clusters and the ring of the ICAM. That's the cell recognizing it. Then, if you put the same T cells down on this caged peptide, they don't see anything. You see just the uniform, more or less uniform T cell receptor distribution. But if you flash it with light, so here's a little octagonal zone. We pulse this with light. So that's a T cell, no patterns. It's actually crawling. Flash it. 7 minutes later, we have a synapse with a core where all the T cell receptor is concentrated. And just nearby, outside that, the cells still are doing anything. So we're kind of excited about this as just a new technique, you know, along the same lines. We've got these synapses, but we can go from a null where it's searching, it's looking for antigen, but it's finding self. And then you pick the place and the time to give it an antigen. And you kind of imagine this, so this is what we're doing now. This is what you have when it's looking at the null. And we've got all these little grids down here, these like pixels. T cell can recognize down lower than one peptide per box. So we can put it in at very low density, the caged peptide, and then all the rest is self. And then just focus a little UV laser spot here and there. And if there's one there, we'll expose it. Do this on lots of cells. And we can more or less, one by one, show an antigen to a T cell in where we want it, when we want it, and ask, you know, how's the T cell respond to this? And so things we're doing is giving it one here and then one there, and asking, when do these two signals meet? How does it know it's seen two instead of one? And it does seem to be able to do that. It does count. And so we'd like to figure out how, and I think this is something you can do with these supported membrane techniques. All right. So I think what I'll do then is just summarize this part and probably have not to talk about the other two parts of the talk. That's fine. So certain things are well established, that there are distinctive patterns on the T cell surface that correlate with different types of behavior. This is probably not unique to T cells. Most cells don't look homogeneous, in fact. And it just happens in the case of the T cell that we see both more than one kind of pattern side by side, and that sort of reveals itself to us clearly. I really think that these things are likely to be very widespread and occurring on different size scales in some cells. T cells also have big patterns, they're easy to see. Doesn't mean they're not there in other cells. The real issue is whether causality could be established. Does the pattern actually, is that the mechanism of regulating? And I think our data suggests that it is, that there is a causal relationship. It's been known that the cytoskeleton is a key regulator of T cell receptor signaling. It's known at a very fundamental level that if you disrupt the cytoskeleton, you disrupt signaling. But the mechanism is less clear. And I think when we know this to be causal, that suggests the mechanism. It is movement. You just physically translocate something from one part of the cell to another, and that changes the way it signals. So that's all you need to do. What about the membrane mechanical forces? Now, I had a lot more to say about that. But what we think from our T cell experiments, and that's why I say the live cell experiments keep us honest, is that if we put these cells down, we were thinking we might see all sorts of, you know, interesting diffusive processes that look like they're directed. No, everything moves in a perfectly straight line right to the middle. That's the cytoskeleton. I think the membrane is critical, though, and it's critical at that first minute. So what I told you is that we only have seen the degradation of signal. We never saw the amplification. That happened on all of our substrates. So we know if you make them non-fluid, you can't amplify the signal. But it was pretty much invisible to us because we couldn't control the time well enough. So using the photopeptide, we can now control time very accurately. And we want to look very carefully at the rise of signaling. So when antigen is there, how quickly do you see the evidence of signaling in the T cell receptor? How quickly do you see the beginning of coalescence of T cell receptors into these little clusters? That's the amplification stage, and it happens very fast. This looks like it's between 1 and 30 seconds. And it happens also over short distances. So that's where we're really suspicious that the membrane mechanical forces and the way the cytoskeleton is connected to the membrane contribute to this. Perhaps in a self-assembly, in some sort of self-assembly.
So have you done that? Have you stressed the T cell and see what happens?
Yeah, we have, actually. And what you see them is incredible. When you stress a T cell, you see it. You can watch it in the microscope, and you can physically see it just moving, trying to work this thing out. And if it catches on to something, it'll move to that spot, sit there for a while, and if it's an antigen, then it will form a synapse. There's a lot of behavior there that I think we
can. But, I mean, how does the synapse formation depend on the stress? Say, I mean, I attach it to an AFM or something.
Oh, we haven't done it.
You see what I mean, to a bead or something. You
know, we haven't done those kind of mechanical stresses, per se. One experiment we have done, which I don't have any data to show here, we made these curvature surfaces, and those are static, of course. But what we showed is that even very shallow curvature gradients, when you impose them on a T-cell, it also redirects the synapse into different patterns, despite the fact that the things diffuse freely over these curvatures. What that tells us is that we're assembling a rigid object in the cell, not just proteins freely following the membrane. And finally, I think this is a problem where the pattern-supported membrane really brings a new capability that directly addresses an issue that's important in biology. And I think as we move along, there's going to be, hopefully, a lot of room to get quantitative about these things and try to ask quantitative questions. Think about physical models and calculate things to see if that's what we see happening in the cell. All right, let me just jump all the way to the end.
And include what you missed out.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So the T-cell project was done, was started by one of my first students, just going to graduate now, Casper Mossman. He's a physics major, and he worked in a semiconductor industry for 2 years before joining the group. And so he knew how to do electron beam lithography, and that was his entree into T-cells. And since then, we've had several other students join on, some of whom will be graduating not too long, Orion or Rosnova. Andy DeMond, he's the one that really made this photo-activated peptide MHC work. A very good student, Joe Hickey. That's the T-cell team. And of course, this has been a long-standing collaboration with Professor Mike Dustin at New York University. He's the one that got us into T-cells. And we actually now have a mouse colony in my lab, and my students are breeding them, amazingly. But yeah, that's been a really good system for us to get into, and I think it's going to be a long-term one.